The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello there. This is Fred Brack reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. We return once again to the July 2021 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month has been sun and fun, and we've talked about a lot of beach stuff. We're still going to talk about beach stuff today, but this being the presumed last reading of the month, we're going to start by reading the article from the Decade series. We're in the 1970s, the decade of disruption. I say presumed because there's a real tight thing about when the magazine's going to arrive relative to my vacation. So we'll see whether we get one more reading of this for early July or we actually start the next month's issue. We'll know that for another week. But anyway, managing our treasured coast. As developers discover North Carolina's beautiful shorelines and beachfront communities, lawmakers make a plan to protect their splendor for generations to come, written as always by Philip Girard. By the close of the 1960s, developers have discovered the coastal counties in a big way. Communities like Manteo and Wrightsville Beach attract streams of vacationers and year-round residents, as well as the businesses to serve them, hotels, restaurants, souvenir shops, and stores. The Herbert C. Bonner Bridge, open for traffic since 1963, carries tens of thousands of tourists to far-flung Hatteras Island. Even on that precarious sandy shore, real estate becomes treasure, and builders erect acres of stilted houses, not just among the traditional communities on the Pamlico Sound side, but also facing the wild and unpredictable Atlantic Ocean. On the night of March 7, 1962, the Ash Wednesday storm clobbered the islands without warning. It lashed the coast with 70-mile-per-hour winds and 30-foot-high waves, wiping out 60 buildings, partially destroyed 1,300 other structures, and opened a new inlet near Buxton that turned Hatteras Village into its own island. But far from dampening development, the storm opened the way for a surge of new building. Population growth in the Outer Banks eventually accelerates to almost double that of other regions in the state. Even with the protections offered by the designation of the Cape Hatteras and Cape Lookout National Seashores, the need to control development in order to preserve the special and fragile nature of the coast, the very quality that makes the area so attractive to visitors and residents, becomes urgent. In 1972, Republican James E. Holzhauser, Jr. wins the governorship, and Democratic James B. Hunt, Jr. is elected to the powerful post of lieutenant governor. Though the two young politicians hail from opposing parties, their agendas are in accord. As Hunt recalls, Holzhauser had a number of new ideas, but one of them was protecting the coast. He proposed a Coastal Management Area Act. Well, he proposed it, but I loved it. The timing couldn't be better. The Federal Coastal Zone Management Act of 1972 makes available 3-year grants to state governments to plan responsible development, management, and preservation of sensitive coastal areas. States are encouraged to coordinate activities ranging from the dredging of inlets to building structures, from preserving wild and recreational areas to offshore oil drilling. States have a great deal of latitude, but they must meet federal oversight requirements, including inventorying and designating areas of particular concern. The idea of coastal stewardship resonates deeply with Lieutenant Governor Hunt. My father was a soil conservationist here in the county of Wilson, he says, so that was very much in my blood. It was a big deal in my life, so the whole idea of preserving the natural resources of North Carolina was very important to me. As the earliest draft of the bill makes clear, unless the pressures of increasing residential and industrial development are brought under coordinated control, the very features of the coast which make it economically, aesthetically, and ecologically rich will be destroyed. It's apparent from the outset that CAMA, C-A-M-A, as the proposed bill comes to be known, will incite opposition from some members of the real estate and development industries, as well as from coastal politicians wary of regulations that might limit their autonomy. Hunt has no doubts about the moral or practical necessity of CAMA, but the very idea of putting into laws that were going to have the effects that this one would have in many minds was just too extreme. Holthouser acts boldly. He puts this bill in immediately, Hunt recalls, of the 1973 legislative session, though it would take until 1974's session to hash out all the details. CAMA covers 20 coastal counties, from Currituck on the Virginia border south to Brunswick on the Southern Carolina border, or on the South Carolina border, and east to the Outer Banks. It encompasses all the coastal waters in the state's jurisdiction, ocean waters, inlets, sounds, and estuaries. A joint Senate-House Legislative Committee, co-chaired by two Democrats, State Senator William Stanton and State Representative Willis Wichard, holds the public hearings in the affected areas of the coast, addressing concerns and incorporating new ideas. Stanton and Wichard do crucial yeoman's work in shaping the bill. Their revised version in 1974 creates a 15-member Coastal Resources Commission to craft policy. Local, I lost my place when I coughed. I'm very sorry. The close cooperation with local officials is key to getting support in the legislature, and most of the negotiation concerns who will serve on what oversight body and how they will be appointed. Local governments will take the lead in planning within their jurisdictions according to standards set by the state, with both responsible for enforcement. Perhaps the most spirited opposition is launched by a coalition of developers from the New Bern area who make their objections clear in open letters mailed to influential leaders along the coast. When the bill is reported out of committee to be debated on the floor of the House, representatives from several districts respond to the developers' pressure by introducing 51 separate amendments that would greatly weaken the proposed system of regulations. One proposed amendment would exempt all existing and approved subdivisions. Another would require a statewide referendum before CAMA could become law. Five others would limit the geographical area covered by CAMA, removing whole counties from its oversight. And fully seven amendments would reduce civil penalties for noncompliance so that they would become virtually meaningless. All of the above and 15 other amendments are defeated. With Holthouser's staunch support, Hunt actively guides the process in the Senate. I remember I put into the right committee and made darn sure that they would be favorable and give it a fair consideration. They did. I'd appointed all the members of that committee, Hunt says, and they came out with a proposal to pass the law, and I don't know that there has ever been a time in the history of North Carolina when the old crowd that wanted very little government involvement was so adamant. Some members of the Senate and the other opponents howled, almost howled, when that bill came out, and they just raised Cain one after another. The 1973 bill goes through some changes, but emerges virtually intact. Built on the original legislative findings, the thrust of the goal is to provide a management system capable of preserving and managing the natural ecological conditions of the estuarine system the barrier dune system, and the beaches, so as to safeguard and perpetuate their natural productivity and their biological, economic, and aesthetic values, and to ensure that the development or preservation of the land and water resources of the coastal area proceeds in a manner consistent with the capability of the land and water for development, use, or preservation based on ecological considerations. Hunt remembers the laborious process of shepherding Kama to a vote. The bill was studied carefully in committee, and it was voted out favorably to enact the Coastal Area Management Act and to protect our coast. Very few states in America had done anything like it, not like we did. One key to success is resolving a long-standing rift between two state agencies that will be essential to carrying out the mission of CAMA, the Department of Natural and Economic Resources, DNER, which oversees environmental concerns, and the Planning Office of the Department of Administration, DOA, which acts as a business manager for the state. Responsible for a wide range of practical activities, from purchasing and contracting to managing state vehicles and property. Now the word goes out from the two men at the top, Secretary of DNER James E. Harrington, himself a former resort developer, and Secretary of Administration William Bondurant, defining clear lines of authority for each agency and pledging mutual cooperation. DNER will be in charge of regulations, and DOA will handle planning. The crafting and passage of CAMA stands as a piece of political virtuosity, requiring the cooperation of senators and representatives from across district and party lines, coastal county commissioners, city councilors, and industry representatives, as well as effective management by state agencies acting in harmony with clarity of purpose. It was a turn in the history of North Carolina, the legislature passing a powerful piece of legislation to commit the whole state to preserving our beautiful, wonderful coast, Hunt recalls. I am so proud that we did that and that we then stuck with it. CAMA is an astonishingly progressive environmental achievement made possible by two leaders of opposite parties who find common ground and service to a greater good than their own personal advancement. To the voters who elected them, and the generations of North Carolinians, yet unborn. Next month in this series, Milestones for Native American Nations. You're listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. Questions and comments, 919-781-1973. Well, this article has a picture of a young lady with a blanket over her head, using a flashlight to read, presumably after hours when she's supposed to be asleep. Tales from the Ghost Coast. When the sun sets on long days at the beach, families still reach for Charles Harry Wedby's beloved Outer Banks legends and spooky stories, years after the raconteur of Nag's Head put them to paper. Charles Harry Wedby gathered up stories of the Carolina coast on the way a beachcomber searches the shoreline, sorting through flotsam and jetsam, sifting over well-worn bits and random pieces until he found the treasures that were worth keeping. With an ear for a well-told story and a delight in the building suspense, he wove these finds into inimitable and enduring yarns, 5 books worth of folk tales about pirates, ghosts, and witches, phantom schooners, shipwrecks, and storms, Native American legends, lost loves, and inexplicable events. Whether the stories were ones that he knew to be true, believed to be true, or fabricated, as he categorized them, each contained kernels of truth about the people, landscapes, and history of the coastal North Carolina places he loved. I wrote it out of a love for this region and the people whom I had known all my life, he said of his first book of coastal tales, Legends of the Outer Banks and Tar Heel Tidewater, published in 1966. Though Wedby's home was in Greenville, his heart was in Nag's Head, a place he once described as the eastern suburb of heaven and earth. His uncle owned one of Nags Head's 13 original cottages, and Wedby spent the summers of his youth there starting in 1911, the year he was born. The family tradition was to spend evenings telling stories, and everyone was expected to pitch in. Those who didn't get dunked got dunked in the ocean. So Wedby learned to always have a tale at the ready. After graduating from college and law school at UNC Chapel Hill, Wedby started his law career in Greenville and later was elected Chief District Court Judge, a position he held for decades. His ability to capture anyone's attention with a good anecdote landed him an invitation to substitute for a host on WNCT-TV's Carolina Today program in 1963. He used some of his airtime to tell a few of the tales he'd heard in Nag's Head, and viewers loved them. Soon after, John F. Blair, a publisher in Winston-Salem, asked him to write down the stories. Wedby got right to work, often writing at a little oceanfront cottage that he and his wife, Rachel, had bought on Nag's Head. That first book included 18 stories, and it was an instant hit, requiring 3 printings in its first year. Ever in search of more stories, Wedby frequently traveled eastern North Carolina, talking to folks. Renee Cahoon, one of the family's members who runs Cahoon's Market and Cottages in Nag's Head, remembers how well the judge loved to talk. He and Rachel would come to Nag's Head for a month or so at a time with their dogs, she says. They were a fixture in the Whale and Whalebone Junction. He'd come into the store and talk for hours. Wedby always signed his books at Cahoon's, and to this day the market has a mural depicting the series. 4 more books followed: The Flaming Ship of Ocracoke and Other Tales of the Outer Banks in 1971, Outer Banks Mysteries and Seaside Stories in 1978, Outer Banks Tales to Remember in 1985, and Blackbeard's Cup and Stories of the Outer Banks in 1989. Years after Wedby passed away in 1990, the publisher collected 13 of his stories into a 6th book called Pirates, Ghosts, and Coastal Lore, The Best of Judge Wedby. Wedby had such a knack for blending real people, places, and historical events with made-up ones that the readers could never tell which was which, and he loved it that way. Readers seeking proof would go to Cedar Grove Cemetery in New Bern at night to see if blood really dripped from the stone archway, and they'd stalk around the woods in Roanoke Island looking for the legendary White Doe and listening for the mournful cry of Wakonas Ska around the Mother Vine. John F. Blair himself once shut down his Winston-Salem office and took his staff to the coast to look for the specter of the Flaming Ship of Ocracoke. Urged on by Wedby's tale, Beachland, photographer Drew Wilson went to great lengths searching for the coffins of the lost colonists that reportedly had been dug up and reburied on the Dare County mainland. Around the time of those digging adventures, he got the chance to meet Wedby and take his photograph for an article. As children, my brother and I had read all the stories from the original book, Wilson said, so it was thrilling going to his beach cottage next to Owen's Motel to meet him. When he told Wedby about his efforts to locate the coffins, the judge laughed heartily and recited a passage from the story. He got a big smile on his face as if he'd hooked me, Wilson says. I knew from that moment that the judge had highly embellished all these stories for entertainment's sake. He was a very witty man who knew how to tell a story. I never went back to Beachland looking for those coffins. Wedby's stories have charmed generations of readers. They are fixtures on local coastal bookshelves and bestsellers in coastal bookstores. Blair, the nonprofit press that acquired the rights to John F. Blair's titles, continues to publish them. It's unusual to print backlist books in hardcover with dust jackets these days, but we do it because people love them. Publisher Lynn York says they fall into the category of classics at this point. The books live on in more ways than one. Upon Rachel's death in 1996, Wedby's will bequeath the royalties to St. Andrews-by-the-Sea Episcopal Church in Nag's Head, which is very close to the house where he spent his youthful summers. It was a surprise boon to the church, similar to the one in A Door for St. Andrews, a tale from Wedby's first book in which a door washes up from the sea and exactly fits a highly unique specification of an empty doorframe at the church. Wedby's legends and stories are time capsules to a simpler era, yet they are just perfect now, as if they were for reading aloud around a campfire or on a beach house swing, or best of all, under a blanket with a flashlight. There's a whole list of places that you can look for Wedby's treasured tales on top shop shelves from Corolla to Calabash, as well as museum stores and historic sites from the coast. For information, visit Blair, B-L-A-I-R, pub.com. And now, the locals' joints, dining on island time. No rush. The clocks on the walls of Oak Island Restaurant are just for decoration. All you really need to know is whether it's Chicken and Dumplings Thursday or Fried Fish Friday. Inside Oak Island Restaurant, along with the usual beachy decorations, the sea turtles swimming along one wall, the clipper ship's pictures and pastel beach scenes, there are 16 antique clocks, 9 of them. Short ones with pendulums that look like grandfather clocks cut off at the knees hang on one wall. A ship with a clock in the hull sails over one booth. 2 barometer clock combinations are tucked into a cabinet, and a round clock from a high school gym hangs over the cashier's counter. All of them are set to different times. The closest to accuracy, the gym clock is 10 minutes slow. It doesn't matter. Regulars know the schedule by the menu. The Wednesday special is shrimp. Thursday is chicken and dumpling day. Friday is their famous fried flounder, a fine version with golden crust on one side and fluffy white fish bursting out with the flick of a fork. The restaurant's late owner, Dave Sigmund, a Navy veteran who served in the 1950s, collected clocks. Even after he left ships and their schedules behind, he used to get up at 4 every morning so he could be at the restaurant by 5:30 to start breakfast and prep for the day. His wife, Mary, just laughs when you ask her about the clocks. "I've got even more at home," she says. Dave died at age 88 in October 2020 from Alzheimer's. He worked until he was 86 when he fell during Hurricane Florence. He was hospitalized for weeks and never able to return to work afterwards. Mary and their daughter Melissa carried on through all that, and now they are carrying on without Dave. "This restaurant was his passion," Mary says. "Even when he couldn't do the kitchen work any longer, he still came in every day until 2018, sitting in a corner booth to roll silverware and paper napkins and greet his friends." The restaurant came as a surprise to Mary, actually. David had been a contractor for years, building hundreds of houses on the island. "In 2000, he told me he bought a restaurant," she remembers. "I said, 'Do you even know how to cook?' It turned out that he did. He had learned as a ship's cook in the Navy years before. When the Sigmunds opened the first Oak Island restaurant, Dave set the menu and the rules. Nothing fried in advance and kept warm under heat lamps. Everything made from scratch, even the lemony tartar sauce. Everything he knew, he taught me," Murray says. "I was surprised how well he could cook. But what really made the restaurant go," she said, "was his personality. Everyone called it Dave's place. He never met a stranger. He was a people person." The Sigmunds sold the first location on 55th Street because Dave wanted to move to the mountains. But Mary's mother got sick, and they decided to stay. In 2007, just before the 2008 financial crash, they bought the current location, a former deli, but they kept the menu the same, a mashup of seafood like shrimp, scallops, oysters, and their specialty, fried flounder, along with a southern-style meat and two menu of country fried steak, chicken, and hamburger steak, with a list of vegetables. The pinto beans, with or without onions, are so popular that the Sigmunds sell them by the bowl. Melissa and her brother Shannon Walker both grew up in the restaurant. Shannon is now a homicide detective in Wilmington, but he still comes back to help. Melissa got her degree in early childhood education and was beginning her own career in Wilmington when the blows started coming. Hurricane Florence in 2018, her father's decline, and the closing of the G.V. Barbie Bridge, the main link to nearby Southport for 6 months. And then came 2020 and the pandemic, followed by Dave's death in the fall. Melissa eventually returned to partner up with her mother. The area was hit hard, Mary says. Bam, bam, bam. We struggled after Florence. We prayed. We cried. We prayed. We cried. I knew that if God got me through that, I could get through COVID. The Sigmunds have cut down on the number of tables and started a busy takeout service. The hours have changed several times while the family figured out what worked. Shannon even sanded the tops of the wood tables to keep sanitizers from making the varnish sticky. Meanwhile, his one-year-old son, Finn, has been spending a lot of his days at the restaurant, sleeping and playing in the office. We're planning to stick with it, Mary says. We have another generation ahead. Oak Island Restaurant is on East Oak Island Drive, in Oak Island, North Carolina. They do not have a website. Well, we just have a couple of minutes left here. There are a couple of photos at the front of the book, a magazine, in a section called View from Here. Sometimes they have one, sometimes they have two, sometimes they have three photos. I would get three this time. Let's see if we can get through them. Coastal Contentment, Nag's Head. The Body Island Lighthouse is a beloved landmark of the Outer Banks, yet many are unaware that this is not the original lighthouse, or even the second. The first attempt was abandoned in 1859 because of structural problems that resulted in a leaning tower. The second was destroyed during the Civil War. Finally, in 1872, the coastal icon was completed, properly this time, and has been illuminating Nag's Head ever since. Well, this is a real nice double page spread here. It starts on a boardwalk that leads from somewhere to the lighthouse across water and a lot of sea marsh. And there's a young lady here standing in the foreground looking off over the land side of the sea marsh. The walkway takes a 90-degree turn to the right, or almost 90 degrees, and straightens out and then bends back in the other direction a little bit and takes you into an area where the lighthouse is, and there's a white fence surrounding the lighthouse property. Now, the Body Island Lighthouse is the one that has alternating black and white stripes. The bottom is white, then black, then white, then black, then white, and finally the top is printed white. And we see just a little bit of the water on the marsh side on the left. Overleaf, a place I know well and like, Oriental. Most folks who live or visit this charming coastal town, fondly known as the sailing capital of North Carolina, are used to seeing the underside of the Robert Scott Bridge from their boats. From early spring through late falls, boaters traverse the waters around this peninsula town, exploring the creeks, watching for wildlife, and soaking up the Carolina sun. We have a big sailboat here going right under the bridge. I've been over that bridge many times myself, making its way out the channel, which is well marked. In a very calm day, so his sails are up, but I wouldn't be surprised if he's got the motor running. And that, my friends, is all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it and that you'll join us next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, or on iTunes. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios 919-832-5138. Thank you for visiting to the North Carolina Reading Service.